Screen Time with John Fardy. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Fardy and this is News Talk's TV and movie show. This week on the show, Stuart Carlin, the acclaimed writer of things like Love, Hate and Taken Down, talks to me about the business of screenwriting. Actor, director and writer Owen Macken on his new movie, Here Are the Young Men. Mark Ryle is here with the week's new releases, and comedian and writer Kevin Gildee chats to me about his favourite movie. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the Newstalk app, or wherever you get your podcasts. And it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. right here on Newstalk. I'm open on Twitter, John_Fardy, or you can email me, screentime@newstalk.com. Good weekend to you all. Hope you're doing well. Lovely weather where I am all week long, which has been great. Now, we spent a long time talking about the Oscars last week with Tim Gray of Variety, so I don't want to spend ages on it this week, but I'm very excited about it. It's Sunday night, not long now. And as we were kind of saying last week, this year, it doesn't happen every year, if you take the Best Picture nominees, there's no garbage in it. No one is there because someone thought they should be for reasons outside of the films. The eight movies that are nominated have all been great, and I've seen 7 out of 8 of them. And they are all great. So I'm looking forward to what happens. We'll talk more of that next week. Now back to the movies. And this week I was watching this.
They say the summer when you finish school is the best time of your life. Your final summer of freedom. When you become a man. It's important. We just didn't realise how important it would be.
Boys, we're free.
I love you so much.
I think you look great pregnant.
Has anyone ever told you you have an extremely punchable face?
I saw a girl get knocked over today. She died.
But you're fine.
Yeah?
Now that was a clip from Here Are the Young Men, which was a successful novel by the writer Rob Doyle, all about three friends who are going to embark on, I guess, their last summer of freedom in Dublin. School is out for the summer. Matthew, played in this movie version by Dean Charles Chapman. Carney, played by Finn Cole, who a lot of people will know from Peaky Blinders. And Rez, played by Ferdia Walsh-Pilo, who people know as the kid, I guess you would call him, from Sing Street. And the three pals are looking forward to this wild summer, and then they witness a car accident where a small child is knocked down, and it clearly traumatizes them. And their friendship devolves and evolves. The Matthew character, played by Dean Charles Chapman, kind of has a good angel on his shoulder in the form of Anya Taylor-Joy, who people will know from Queen's Gambit, who's gone on to huge things in that role. She's his early girlfriend in the movie, and she wants the best for him. The Finn Cole character, Carney, is kind of his worst angel. He starts out as a guy who just wants to pal around and drink with him for the summer, but then things take a weird turn and he heads off to America and then comes back and we're not sure what happens in America. Rez, the Ferdia Walsh-Pilo character, also suffers horrifically from what he sees on the road that day. So it's a story kind of about toxic male friendship and three men negotiating a difficult time in their lives. It's a really well put together movie. The music is great in it. Joy Division, all sorts of stuff. There's a touch of Trainspotting about it in a way. It's probably a darker movie than that, even though Trainspotting was pretty dark at times. Now, it's directed and written based on the novel by Rob Doyle by Owen Macken, who's a real bright light of the Irish acting, directing and writing scene. Owen has acted in things like Fair City, the BBC show Merlin. He's currently down in Australia filming something for a big American outfit. He's written movies, he's directed movies. He was also a male model at one stage. So he's a really interesting guy. And I got to talk to him about this project of his, Here Are the Young Men, which, as I say, he wrote and directed. Have a listen to this. So, Owen, I understand that this has pretty much been finished for the last 2 years. Is that right? It must have been killing you to have this done and not have it out in the world.
Yeah, I mean, not quite that long, but we were supposed to release it last year.
So we'd kind of planned to release kind of early summer last year. And then obviously like a lot of films and projects, that all changed. So it kind of got to a case now where at this stage, we want to get it out and get it released. So yeah, it's been a difficult, like everything for everybody, you know, it's been a difficult wait, but it's been a minute. Yeah.
Yeah, I can imagine. So listen, now I'm not going to lie to you because I never do. I haven't read the novel, the source material. So I was going in blind, but I really enjoyed the movie. Was it always your intention whenever you read the book that, you know, this would be a great film?
Yeah, it was. I mean, the reason why I wanted to make it was because I think Rob Doyle is a brilliant writer, and his writing is very visceral. And I've used that word a few times to describe his writing because that's how it came across to me. And Richard Bulger, our producer, actually came to me and asked me to. He said he wanted to produce a film about a book that I'd written, and I said to him I didn't want to do that because I'd read Rob's book, and it was just so much more cinematically and visually and thematically interesting to me. So I really wanted to explore the characters and the themes that Rob touched on, and I thought that the grit that he got in the characters lent itself visually to something really interesting, but also musically, which is really important to me.
When we look at the actual story, the character Matthew, he's these two pals who, you know, it's kind of male toxic friendship to a certain extent. And what I liked about it as well, it was in the noughties. It was a different kind of time. We were in the throes of the boom, you know. It was a different Dublin that we I grew up in Dublin. It was a different Dublin that would come, you know, 10 years later, and one that we're in now. Were all those factors kind of the appeal for you, this story of toxic, vaguely toxic male friendship, but important male friendship at the same time, and also set in this kind of, you know, post-boom Dublin?
The thing was, you know, I have a nostalgia for that period, because that's also when I finished school and went to college, and that's why the music was such a big reference point for me in terms of the Chemical Brothers and Primal Scream and even like Joy Division and all that Slow Dive and stuff. And for me, that became embodied with the film, kind of how it felt, and for me, I felt that it needed to stay in that time period because there was that kind of sense of being able to look back at growing up in Dublin at that age, obviously with a lot more extreme situations happening in the movie, but deliberately a lot of that is heightened to allow that framework for examining the kind of moral code that these characters have or don't have. And I think that the theme of toxic masculinity and male friendships, I think it still abides today as it did 10, 15, 20 years ago. And I wanted to explore that without making it, this is what this film's about, but kind of create this sort of cinematic experience. But also, if you really got into it, you're like looking at these relationships between these young men who are figuring themselves out and making really bad decisions that affect other people, and not just like some, you know, small little bad decisions, like they did some bad things. These are big, heavy moral choices that afflict them.
Yeah, they certainly are. Now, I don't want to single anyone out in particular, but I will, just because Finn Cole, who people will know from Peaky Blinders, who plays Carney, is just brilliant in it. What I loved about him was he was charismatic. You know, you kind of, at the start, I was thinking, this is a guy's guy in a kind of way. You know, I'd like him as my pal. And then he becomes terrifying at times, like really berserk, and that icy cold. This guy could do anything, you know. And my wife watched it with me, and she was actually saying the same thing. That guy is spine-tinglingly frightening. Did you always have him in mind as the guy you wanted for it, or did he just inhabit it once he showed up?
No, I always wanted Finn. I mean, I think Finn's magnetic. He's brilliant. And I think that really the film for me, first and foremost, was about finding the dynamics between the cast. And, you know, and that was, you know, if you don't have the right actors to embody these characters, for me, it wouldn't have worked. And Finn, you know, I cast Matthew first, Dean Chapman. And once I knew he was Matthew, I was able to kind of go build everything around him. But Finn immediately, Finn was actually the only person I actually met to play Carney, because I knew once I met Finn and saw him, I was like, this is who this guy has to be. Because he's got that sense, as you say, that charisma where you're like, oh yeah, this guy would totally be your friend. But he had to represent you know, I feel like that person that you all have grown up where there's always one guy who's kind of cool. Everything's always a bit edgy on the extreme, but always like, but he's kind of like, he's your man and you like him and you want to be friends with him. But in the film, Finn is the character also then just goes too far.
Yeah.
And I wanted to explore that sense that, you know, you always have that one person, but what if he does go too far? And what if what he's doing is no longer a joke? And these things that you think are cool, but are a bit aggressive and violent and don't quite agree with, but I will let him away with it. Mm. He goes, you know, he goes to these other places then.
Yeah. And he also literally goes off to America. And the way you do it in the movie is his experiences in America are told through this game show. It's a really interesting kind of flight of storytelling or whatever you might call it. You probably have a better name for it than that. But I'm wondering why you chose to do that. It's very affecting, but all his American bits are him and this kind of talk show, first being a guest and the host.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think my movie influences growing up were kind of like Requiem for a Dream and Natural Born Killers and Bronson and that type of stuff. And I wanted to bring some of that thematically into the film. But also, I remember going to America, and when you're before everything became a bit more homogenized, a bit more accessible, when you went to America in the late 90s, early 2000s, it was such a huge deal and everything was so different over there. And there is that sense of sort of a freedom that we don't have in Ireland now. It's not the same anymore. But that's what I wanted to kind of get across, that he was over there and seeing no responsibilities.
Mm.
And that idea of being away whereby no one knows who you are. And if no one knows who you are, then who are you answering yourself to?
Mm.
And I wanted to push that to the extreme, and by doing it in that kind of visual metaphorical way to look at the game show is almost everything around Carney's character, from the media, from a social influence point of view. And that's all sort of, he just becomes this character in his own world, because he basically goes into it, his own head, and he's kind of sort of seeing himself operating the world through his own eyes. Mm. And he's just created this, you know, this fake world for himself to exist in.
Yeah, well, it's very well done. You know, one thing I thought of there when you were talking was, you know, I watched plenty of movies for this gig and lots about, you know, people coming of age and all that. It was refreshing that there was really no social media in the movie. Were you aware of that when you were looking back, that there was no talk of Twitter or Instagram or anything like that? I only realized that kind of as I was talking to you there, but it was kind of freeing not to have these young guys looking at their phones.
Yeah, well, I mean, there was a brief moment when there was a conversation whether or not we would set the movie in a contemporary setting, because it would have been easier to do that. But I just think that it would have changed it. I just don't like having phones and films and Twitter and Instagram and so forth. It also would have made everything even slightly more immediate. So like now, if you go anywhere, like I'm talking to you in Australia, and we can just have this conversation on Zoom in 6 seconds, you know. 20 years ago, you couldn't do that. It wasn't as easy. I remember having to get a mobile phone card just to call my mom once a week.
Yeah.
You know, and like you have your 100 minutes of international calls or something, and it might take 10 minutes of that call would just be the connection.
Yeah.
And if they went to voicemail, you suddenly had no minutes anymore. You're like, oh no. So I just think I wanted to kind of keep that sense of there's a little bit of isolation to that, and everyone isn't as connected, which I think was important then, even for emotionally, for how these characters develop.
Yeah, God, I have a memory of ringing my mother at 2 a.m. with one of those cards from New York, scraping off the code on the back, now that you say it.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, there's always cheering them on the back of the telephone, wasn't it? You're always kind of holding away from your ears. You're like, I can't hear you. You're like, I'm not putting it closer to my ear because it's kind of gross.
Anyway, before we go down a rabbit hole of kind of that, let me ask you, there's what kind of rescue some of, you know, the tragedy in the movie is Anya Taylor-Joy's character. She's a real breath of fresh air. She again, I was looking at that going, hang on, she's the lady from Queen's Gambit. That role has been interstellar for her. Had that happened when she was in the movie, or was that yet to happen when you were filming?
No, she did Queen's Gambit after we'd finished filming.
Right, okay.
But Anya, I'd worked with Anya on a short film called Cross McGlen with a guy called Beau Ferris, mm-hmm. who's actually the first AD on Umbrella Academy, and it was Beau's first film. And you could just, Anya's just superb, and she's, some of the people in the movie are people I've actually worked with, and you can judge people very quick and go like, this person's fantastic, and she was brilliant. So with the character of Jen, I knew I wanted Anya to play that part. So like all of them, once I knew she could do it, we worked on the character a little bit, because it was really important that Jen was that moral barometer for the film, but also that she stood alone as a kind of fully fleshed, strong character, and she wasn't just being influenced by the guys. And I wanted that specifically, that her character felt different to the three male characters in the movie, because she wasn't dependent on any of them.
Mm.
And that was really important. She brought, she's superb, so she brought a brilliant kind of freshness to that.
The film has my blessings. I not that it needs them, but I did really enjoy it. You're down in Australia now for Le Bris, which is all about a massive sinkhole in Los Angeles or something along those lines. I just read the top line yesterday. What's it about exactly?
Well, it's called La Brea, but
La Brea. Sorry,
it does actually look like La Bra or something. But
yeah, it's two Irishmen talking halfway across the world.
We're talking this American show. We're going, oh yeah, La Bra, yeah. I did say that. It's a little bit like Lost. It's a high concept show, sort of based around the La Brea tar pits in California, and it's a kind of I can't really say too much about the show because I'm being told about it. We're in rehearsals and prep at the moment, and I'm actually being told more about it, and it's actually pretty fascinating, and it's going to places I didn't expect. But it's it is this sinkhole opens and up, and these people get sucked into it, and I don't really want to explain too much more about that, except that I play this this ex-Air Force pilot with PTSD who has these visions of what's going on, and it's all kind of quite complex. Kind of imagine Lost meets Independence Day.
Wow, well, it took you tremors there by the sounds of things as well, maybe.
That's true. Yeah.
Well, despite not knowing how to pronounce it, maybe I should, help you with the PR for it. Like, listen, then finally, I read a thing that you'd made a comedy called The Cookies, but that's yet to see the light of day. What's the story with that?
Wow. I don't know. I made that a long, long, long time ago. Myself and Tom Hopper actually made this little thing. That was when we were both, just before we both did Merlin. And The Cookies was kind of I've made a couple of independent films that were kind of like training grounds. You're kind of experimenting with stuff, learning about stuff. And it was a really interesting little comedy sort of pilot that we just never kind of quite got picked up. I can't believe you brought that up.
I'm sorry. That was intriguing to me.
I mean, it isn't. Tom Hopper's great in it. He plays a dance coach in tight pants. I probably should just release it. It'd be very popular now.
Yeah. Well, look, more importantly, Here Are the Young Men is available on video on demand platforms from next Friday. That's the 30th of April. It's a really good movie. I'll be telling people to watch it. I'm glad you're gainfully employed, because I know it's been a tough time for actors everywhere. So it's good to see that your career is continuing to go from strength to strength. And as I say, that you're in work down in Australia. Owen, thanks a million.
It's been a pleasure, you're a gentleman. Thanks very much.
Owen Macken there talking to me about Here Are the Young Men, which is available on various video on demand platforms from next Friday, the 30th of April. And it's well worth a watch. Up next, the writer of Love Hate, Stuart Carolan, on the importance of failure.
Screen Time on News Talk.
Now you're listening to Screen Time, News Talk's TV and movie show. Now, taking place all this week is Ireland's first screenwriting festival. It's supported by Screen Skills Ireland and Griffith College. The Dublin International Screenwriting Festival will feature contributions from the creators of some of Ireland's favourite television shows and indeed film productions, including Derry Girls creator Lisa McGee, Roddy Doyle, and my next guest, Stuart Carolan, who is one of Ireland's most successful writers for television, whose credits, of course, include Love Hate. And most recently, he's been working on the second season of The Alienist, now streaming on Netflix. And I'm delighted to say he joins me now. Hi, Stuart. How are you?
How are you, John?
I'm very well. Stuart, I was thinking about, you know, the idea of screenwriting. I talk to actors, directors, occasionally screenwriters all week long. Everything else in terms of a production, maybe you can get around. A problematic actor, problematic director, maybe, you know, there's a problem with a location or something. But the screenplay, in a way, is the most important thing for a film or a TV show, because it's the start and ending of everything, right?
Yeah, I don't know if it's the most important thing, but it's certainly, if you've got a problem with the screenplay, everything else is about fixing that problem. So,
and in terms of you chatting to students and stuff during this screenwriting festival, and anyone who's interested in it, I was chatting to you beforehand, and you were talking about the idea of, you know, failure, and you know, Beckett or whatever, fail better. Like, we have this myth that, you know, oh, I'm going to write a screenplay, or I'm going to write a book, or I'm going to do anything. I'm going to make a radio show, and I'm going to sit at home and I'm going to write it, and it's going to go out into the world and be successful. Like, that almost never happens. I'm assuming that's your take as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, there's certain things, I think, if you're trying to write in, you know, for television, there's certain things that are given, you know, like you have to know the craft, you know, you need to know the way it works. You need to have something to say. You need to know the rules, even if you're going to break them, you know? So let's say you take those things that are given. I think after that, the most important thing is actually grit. Just perseverance. You know, it's pretty tough, because so many, a lot of people working will tell you about this. It's all about, you know, people are always saying no to you, you know, so it's no at any point. So like I have, you know, I genuinely have lost count of the number of projects that I've been involved in, written pilots for, written long treatments, researched at length, and haven't happened. And some of them have been pretty good. Some of them have, you know, been, you know, a lot of them have been international, and they fall at the last hurdle, or they're just not what they're looking for, or whatever the reason. So so I think that's a kind of crucial, you know, quality that you need, is just that perseverance, just to keep working. That's it.
And just so people are clear, this is, you know, still goes on for you. You're not talking about Stuart in a garret, you know, starving away 20 years ago. I mean, you still have projects that don't get off the ground for all those reasons you explained.
Oh, I mean, this year I've had three. I generally try and juggle about, you know, 5, 6, 7 projects. And so each of them, people think, you know, you're just, you know, you're writing at your desk and you're going, I'll wait for inspiration to strike you. And it's not really like that. It's, you know, if you're looking at a particular area, whatever it is, you do a lot of research, read a lot of books, really immerse yourself in a feeling, you know, like a backstory, to even begin to think about characters or a story. So each time, you know, you're kind of like going to the well each time on that, you know? That's the reality, you know?
I mentioned The Alienist at the start there, and, you know, because that's a big show, you know, people know you, Taken Down, Love, Hate, these gritty Irish pieces of work, very much of the place. Suddenly to be in the milieu of, you know, late 18th century New York, but also to be in the milieu of this large beast of Paramount and TNT and stuff like that. Is that a big adjustment for you?
Well, yes and no. I mean, absolutely, 100%. It's a massive big thing in one way, in the sense that, you know, Love Hate was really made on a pretty small budget. I mean, you know, even by English terms, you know, it's like 600,000 an episode, which it sounds a lot in some ways, but it's really very little. And depending, let's say The Aliens with Angel of Darkness, it was like roughly 80 to 90 million, you know, for 8 episodes, depending on how you cost it.
Yeah.
The principles are kind of the same, in the sense that there's still a reality about how you do it, right? So there's that thing. But in one sense, the system I didn't go from there straight into the Alienist. There was, again, back to the failure. I'd done a number of different things that kind of came together. So if the number of projects that had failed in the meantime, if they hadn't happened, then the Alienist wouldn't have happened for me.
Yeah.
For example, I'd worked with Morgan, like the great Morgan O'Sullivan, and so I'd worked with Morgan on a couple of things, but I'd done this remake of the Robert De Niro film Ronin. So we'd done that TV series for MGM, and again, that fell. And then another project I'd been involved in was with again with Morgan and James Flynn was Penny Dreadful, and John Logan, because there was I talked to them about possibly doing a fourth season. So I met John Logan, went over to LA, met Showtime. And then, so I ended up writing like two episodes in a Bible, and that didn't happen. So when I got the opportunity to pitch for The Alienist, all of these things came into play. You know, I'd also worked with Studio Canal and Anonymous Content. So one of the producers, Rosalie Swedlin, had been, I'd worked with her before. So there was all of these different things that came together. So, you know, so I had worked with it in that studio system before, even something like Penny Dreadful, that's set in the 1890s. So, albeit in London. So I had kind of immersed myself in Gothic literature.
Yeah.
So it's slightly different, but I'd written in that kind of style. So all of those things were a factor. But
sure.
The big factor was that with Love Hate, it's like a serious baptism of fire. And I really think that the difference is, I mean, I think it was, you know, it's like having a guerrilla army. You know what I mean? It's a bit like the numbers are a bit bigger, but the concepts are still the same.
Yeah. And just by the by, I like that Robert De Niro movie, Ronin, the car chases and all that. Will that just never see the light of day as a TV show, or will someone else pick it up, or does it just go on the cutting room floor for now?
Yeah, generally what happens is that's it. You know, you never know. I mean, if you like specifically on that one, I don't know. I mean, that didn't happen. We pitched to a couple of people. It didn't happen. And often it's because somebody's got something similar, you know, Amazon and Jack Ryan. But then, you know, they can take it. MGM could take it and give it to somebody else, and somebody else has a different take. It could have a different iteration with somebody else. And then, you know, like, you know, if you read about different shows, even like, let's say, The Queen's Gambit, that took 20 years to get out of the traps.
But look, as you're saying, it's informed everything, you know, that led you to where you are now. So there's merit in it, even though I'm sure it doesn't feel that way at the time. Listen, you mentioned Love Hate, and well, I mentioned it, and I'm not going to spend age on it because I'm sure you're, you know, tired talking about it ad nauseam. But, you know, I was watching Reeling in the Years the other day, and it's part of the latest round of that. You know, you've arrived when you're featured on Reeling in the Years, right? Yeah. But just one thing about it. In terms of Nidge and Tom Vaughan Lawler, and he became, because people forget when it started, Aidan Gillen was the head honcho in essence. Was it always part of your plan that Nidge would assume the throne? Had you always thinks that this guy could be the real villain of the piece, or did that just develop as it went on in your own head? And
no, it developed as it went on, but I mean, it's a bit of both, really. I mean, I kind of knew that with Aidan, I wanted to do, for a number of reasons, but it was kind of like life and death of a gang boss, because it was the reality that was going on. You know, somebody rises very quickly and then their life has ended pretty soon as they start getting mentioned a lot in the newspaper. So that was a kind of story. And also I thought that on a very practical level, you know, we're not in a position to sign people into 7-year deals. So, I think that, yeah, you know, we had him for the first season. I thought we could have him for the second season, but, you know, Aidan's in demand a lot. So I thought we'd be pushing ourselves, you know, pushing our luck to keep him there. So that was a kind of practical reality, but it was determined also at the same time by that sense of this is the truth. This is the kind of true story. And then in terms of the Tom Vaughan Lawler, I always had a vague notion of the Nidge character in that way. You know, this kind of the Nidge weasel, that sense.
Yeah.
But really, there was a huge element of it was just I was completely you know, like everybody else, taken by Tom Von Lawler's performance, and you see these possibilities, and you know, so yeah, partly you're writing because you have certain ideas, stories in your mind, and you see it. But absolutely, the way that actors do it, the energy they bring, all of those impact in terms of the way you tell the story.
Yeah. And tell me this then, for Taken Down, which I really enjoyed, you know, at its heart, it, for people who don't know, it takes place in direct provision. And it was, in essence, two female leads. You had the policewoman played by Lynn Rafferty, Jen Rooney, I think was the character's name. And then the lady, Abeni, yes. The widowed mother in direct provision. Like, it seemed like a big jump in a way. And even though it's still very much of the now, but were you, you know, was part of you, you're writing about two women, was part of you thinking, you know, I need a complete 180 from Love Hate?
No, I mean, what that was really, you know, that began with the writer Joe Spain.
Yeah.
So that's where that really started. Kind of, I was kind of producing that, and I started writing it with her. But I think with that, it just you became gripped by the story of direct provision. And so what was interesting about that, I don't really think in those other you know, I don't really, you're more interested in the story. And the truth of a story. So what happens was, what became really fascinating was just talking to people who had been in direct provision and trying to give a sense of that, and trying to not sensationalize it, you know, not you know, with a lot of these kind of like, you know, cop shows where somebody is killed, it can focus simply about that and not, you don't like, so with this, there was, our intention was to try and show the humanity behind a victim. So we ended up doing a lot more, I guess, showing that side of things about direct provision than necessarily the police investigation. But I think it's not like that you start off necessarily with a grand scheme. It's absolutely influenced by, you know, the story you're researching.
Is it true, or is it just some form of hyperbolic journalism, that in a way your writing career began when you were in radio and you were having a turbulent flight and you had a moment of, I don't know, clarity, and you thought, I need to do something different with my life?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it's not so much, it wasn't like I need to do something different. It's, I wanted to write, and I have kind of always, when I look back, I, you know, I've always been writing. And, you know, even before Love Hate, I've, you know, I've realized I'd written two separate things, and then I'd written a six-parter, and then another, or I'd written two episodes of another series, you know, different things. And I actually forgot about, you know, you forget about the things you've done. So in terms of that, yeah, I really felt that I had a couple of things I wanted to write. I didn't think in terms of I want to be a writer. I thought, I knew that that's what I wanted to do, but I thought kind of now or never. So the thing, I ended up writing my first play, it was called Defender of the Faith. So yeah. So I had this sense of it, and I thought, I'm never going to really do this unless I do it. And then that's kind of how it began. Now there's a couple of bit like sort of bumps in the road in between. But ultimately, you know, it was a decision. I didn't accidentally do it. I decided, yeah, I'm gonna do this. There were so many things that haven't happened. That's what I keep stressing. But it's really, you just sit at the desk, try not to meet people for lunch, try not to go out, try and just immerse yourself in certain worlds. And then every time, you know, there's a setback, you throw it over your shoulder and move on.
And then finally, and to bring it full circle, so what are you working on now, or what's next?
Well, again, same thing. I mean, I've got a deal with Paramount Television, so I'm working with a couple of things with them. There's one project in particular. And then there's something else I'm doing with the BBC. And then there's about two other things. So
of which you can't tell me anything about.
I'm superstitious.
Fair enough.
I don't mind talking about the stuff that has failed a couple of years ago. But I worry if I mention it, then it's guaranteed to fail.
Yeah, okay. Well, look, we'll watch this spot. Stuart Carlin, one of Ireland's best-known writers for television and indeed plays and all sorts of things, is talking at this week's Dublin International Screenwriting Festival. His message is definitely, if you are writing, you need to keep at it and then some. Stuart, thank you very much.
No problem. Good talk to you, John.
Now you're listening to Screen Time, News Talk's TV and movie show. It's new release time, and we turn to this week's new releases in the company of Mark Ryle. Now, we're getting 1 week ahead of ourselves because we're going to look at Nomadland, which is not out, available for Irish people certainly, until next Friday, the 30th of April on Disney+. We're doing it this week because, one, I think it's going to clean up at the Oscars and a lot of people will be talking about it, and two, me and Mark have a very special show next week, which I'll tell you about later. So we will be talking about Nomadland, and also another new movie available on video on demand platforms this week called Black Bear. More of that anon. Without further ado, let me introduce the man, the legend, the beanpole with muscles, Mark Ryle. How are you?
Yeah, fine, John. How are you?
I'm great. And I'll tell you why I'm great. I really enjoyed Nomadland. It's one I could easily mispronounce. I keep going to call it No Man's Land from
Indeed.
The seminal Billy Joel song of 1993, but it's Nomad Land. It's very different to any Billy Joel song you've ever heard. Maybe a bit like a Bruce Springsteen song in some ways.
Six degrees of Billy Joel or Bruce Springsteen.
It is with me. Sometimes only three. But listen, it's going to be available to watch next week on Disney+. We're talking about it this week because, as I say, there's going to be a lot about it. And there is a lot about it. It's loosely based on a book, but it's kind of a fictionalized version of that. Just tell listeners what's going on. It's one of those movies people might have heard about but have no idea what it's about.
Yeah, I mean, they've probably been hearing about it for a long time. Frances McDormand, she plays Fern. She's a widow who has lost not only her husband, but her job and her house. Fern comes from a town called Empire in Nevada that disappeared when the gypsum plant closed down after 88 years. So she's also lost her town because...
And that's real world. That happened.
That's real world.
The book I mentioned deals with that, yeah.
The postcode disappeared after the plant closed down. So, like, the town is essentially gone. She now lives in a converted van and she travels around Nevada from one 0 hours contract job to another, and she forms these... ad hoc connections with fellow nomads. That's it in a nutshell.
Yes, indeed, and she does.
It's a hard movie to describe because it's Nomadland. It's a hybrid, and it's not a narrative drama, and it's not a documentary, but it has characteristics of both. There is a story here, and Frances McDormand's character has a dramatic arc that is, you know, it's incredibly moving and sad, but it's all told through real characters, through non-professional actors.
Yeah, most of the actors are real-life nomaders, people who have been dispossessed or chosen to leave the rat race or mainstream America and drive around in vans and caravans and meet and try and establish some kind of off-road community, quite literally, in a way. Obviously, Frances McDormand and one or two other of the players are actors. When I said about the Bruce Springsteen thing, I was actually being serious because, you know, Bruce Springsteen would often write about, you know, forgotten America and wide open landscapes where people are homeless and stuff like that. Like, it's very much, and we'll get to the Oscar buzz in a minute, but Oscars love this kind of stuff because it's very much a tale of what's wrong with America, right? The idea that people in their 50s and 60s have to go on the road because they can't afford healthcare, they can't afford places to live.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think in general, I think we are very bad with taking care of our elderly. I think there is...
American people seem to be worse at it, if you can generalize.
I think in general... As a race, I think we're pretty bad at it. There's a lyricism here, you know, and there's a melancholy. Going back to the Bruce Springsteen thing, there's a melancholy in the constant making of connections, and then the breakup of these small friendships, and also in, you know, there's a sadness inherent in the sight of a truck kicking up dust as it disappears into the horizon, leaving. Frances McDormand's character alone again, but never for long. There's always another connection further on down the road.
Yeah.
I think I've probably said this many times before, but what struck me watching this is, you know, what a privilege it is to be around when Frances McDormand is working. I think when the revised history of film is being written, she's going to be talked about beside Catherine Hepburn and Bette Davis. And I think going all the way back to Blood Simple and Raising Arizona, she has never been less than exceptional. She is just consistently brilliant, and she is brilliant in this.
She is completely brilliant in it. And you know what? She's never herself in a weird kind of way. There's never a hint of her acting. You can never see the rivets, you know.
No.
She's just wholly in whatever character she was playing. And, you know, I go back to Three Billboards Outside Missouri because I loved her in that. But my God, she was brilliant in this. And, you know, I have a problem now because all year long I've been saying Vanessa Kirby I think should win Best Actress because I just think she was brilliant in Pieces of a Woman. Now I'm not so sure. Not to diminish Vanessa Kirby, but Frances McDormand is brilliant in this. I want to take one slight, not really an exception with you, but you're saying about there isn't a huge narrative here. At the same time, if this
I'm saying there is a narrative.
Okay, good. Sorry, I must have drifted off, you know.
Perhaps I misspoke.
No, because there's very much a beginning, middle and end. And even though there's a documentary feel to about it, plenty of stuff happens in terms of her tenure on the road. And you know, what I also like about it is, you know, the cinematography. I know sometimes that turns people off, but by God, it looks beautiful.
It does.
You're
much
more cine literate than I am. But there was a scene in it towards the end where I thought, they're really aping The Searchers there by John Ford with John Wayne when she's framed in a shot in the doorway. Like every scene in it looks brilliant. And again, it brings me back to that Bruce Springsteen kind of thing. She was like, they're painting at times. They really are. Like these open American vistas. They look scary. They look beautiful. They look cold. It just looks amazing.
I hate to keep going back to Terrence Malick, but it does have that Terrence Malick magic hour Badlands thing going on. It's a really good looking movie.
Yeah, it really is. So, what would you say stars wise?
I am going to give it. I'm going to give it 4. It's a really profoundly affecting piece of work.
Yeah, you see, I'm going to give it a 5 again. I know that's 3 weeks in the row. I have only done that in the last 3 weeks. I haven't done that in probably a year.
It's award season, John.
That must be it. It's bleeding into me, but I just thought this is a superb film from start to finish. It's beautiful. It stays with you. You go to bed thinking about it. You wake up thinking about it. You know, where are we going with life? Where are we going with the world? It's an amazing film. So I'm giving Nomadland 5. Mark is giving it 4, but that's high for us respectively, I would say. Let's take a quick clip.
Parts and labor, $2,300 and tax.
I just looked up the value on your van. With that high a mileage, you're looking about $5,000 at the most.
I'd probably recommend taking that money and putting it towards a different vehicle.
I can't do that. I can't do that. See, I spent a lot of time and money building the inside out, and a lot of people don't understand the value of that, but it's not something like we can. I live in there. It's my home.
Now, that was a clip of Nomadland, available next week. We're getting in a week early on Disney Plus for Irish viewers. We are both giving it a huge recommendation. Now, Mark, I want to talk to you about Oscars briefly, but before I get to that, we have another much different movie available this week from Friday on video on demand platforms, Black Bear, which is quite the trip.
It certainly is. Yeah, it's a weird little movie and I'm not entirely sure how I feel about it.
I kind of agree with you.
Yeah, it's kind of pretentious and up itself, a lot like myself. I suppose you could say that Black Bear, it's a movie with notions is the best way of describing it. Audrey Plaza is Allison. She's an ex-actor, now writer-director of small, unsuccessful movies. And she arrives at this woodland artist retreat run by Gabe and his pregnant partner, Blair. Allison has come to the retreat to start work on her new screenplay. And Gabe and Blair are ex-Brooklynites who seem to hate each other in a very, very polite way. And in the evening, Allison has an uncomfortable, passive-aggressive dinner with her hosts. And then the after-dinner conversation gets intense. And we can't really talk about the start of this movie without talking about the whole thing, but we don't want to do that. So,
well, I think it's okay to say to listeners, because there's no other way to describe it, that it's two movies, because the movie goes for about 40 minutes or an hour, and then it changes completely into basically a different movie where the same three characters are playing slightly different versions of the three main characters from the first movie, right?
Yeah, it is. It's split into two acts, and they're both shot in a completely different style. And the first act is much shorter, and it's shot in a kind of a standard traditional, almost horror style. And the music in this segment as well suggests horror. It's very ominous and overdramatic. And then the much longer second act is done in this sort of reportage, Paul Greengrass, handheld documentary style.
John Cassavetes, you might even say.
John Cassavetes, yeah. But they're two very, very different parts. And the second half is the bulk of the movie, really.
Yeah.
But I mean, what does it mean? I should be able to come on here and say with some authority, oh, it's about this or it's trying to say that. But really, I have no idea what Black Bear is trying to achieve or trying to say. I think the nearest understanding I can come to about this is that Act One could be considered as a first draft of what eventually becomes Act Two.
Yeah, yeah. I just keep saying meta. That usually gets me out of a hole whenever I don't know how to describe anything.
Solipsistic is another...
yes, to an extent, yes, I'd go along with that. I remember when I first came across the term solipsism, and I was about 17, I thought I was the smartest guy in the room. I barely knew what it meant. But anyway.
I only say that because one of the characters is described as solipsistic in it. I'm not using that word to be deliberately of myself.
But this little banter we're having here, if I can call it banter, in a way points to the problem with the movie, because you really don't know, and by you, I mean both of us and anyone who watches it, I think you're really not sure what's going on. And sometimes that can be evocative, but other times there's a very thin line to something being about absolutely nothing or being the most important thing in the world. And
yeah,
I think this is on the wrong side of the fence.
Yeah, I'd agree. Yeah. I mean, it's an interesting setup, but on the whole, I don't think the structure really works, and there doesn't seem to be much point to it. There's a bit in the first act where one character says to another, she's talking about the director's movies, and she's annoyed that they don't have any meaning attached to them. Well, you know, quite so. I was annoyed as well. I think it's really just it's an unpleasant movie about, you know, unattractive characters in a nutshell.
Yeah. Yeah, it doesn't really work. As a great man once said, I think it might have been me actually, the juice isn't worth the squeeze. What are you going to say, what are you going to say, Star Wars? If only we were watching Star Wars, what are you going to say, stars wise?
I'm giving it a 3 because I think it's certainly interesting, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it's good.
Okay, I thought you were going to give it a 2. No. I would do exactly the same thing. I would give it 3 because you would only watch it once. You watch it to see what's going on, but I don't think you'll ever revisit it. So no. Black Bear gets a 3 from me on Mark, now available on video on demand platforms from this Friday, the 23rd of April. Now, Mark, we did a lot on the Oscars last week, but listeners would like to know your views. What's going to win Best Picture, do you think?
Very quickly, I think Best Picture, I think Nomadland is going to win Best Picture.
Do you think it should win?
I think it should, yeah. I think also think Chloe Zhao will probably get Best Director.
Best Actor?
Best Actor, I think it's going to be Chadwick Boseman.
Do you think he should win?
I think it's a weird year. I think that's a fair shout, all right. I would say Mank is going to run away in a lot of the technical categories, but it doesn't really have a chance in any of the big ones.
Yeah. And what about Best Actress?
Best Actress, I'm going to call Frances McDormand, rightly so.
I think you're right. I mean, I think if there's an outside shot, it's probably going to be Carey Mulligan, but it's more than likely going to be Frances.
Yeah, I know. We'll sure we'll see on Sunday.
Indeed we shall.
Quickly, just the supporting. I think Yu Jung is going to win for Minari.
Yeah.
And I think if the supporting actor goes to anyone but Daniel Kaluuya, I will be gobsmacked.
What about, but do you think he should win it?
Oh God, absolutely.
What about Paul Grassi in Sound of Metal?
I think, you know, when you're, I know it's just Daniel Kaluuya is just, that was a lead performance, and he's nominated in the supporting. I don't think, it's just, nobody has a chance against him, I don't think.
Okay, fair enough. You're forthright in your predictions, which is good. So get down to the bookies now, folks. Mark has called it, and I'll give out his email address at the end of the show in case he's wrong and you can
don't gamble.
Barrage him. Okay, well, listen, thank you for that, Mark. Time will tell.
Thanks, John.
Up next, comedian Kevin Gildee on his favourite movie.
Screen Time on News Talk.
Now you're listening to Screen Time, News Talk's TV and movie show. It's that stage of the week where we talk to someone well known about their favourite movie. Delighted to be joined now by comedian, writer, playwright, and lately, bookshop owner. More of that in a moment. Kevin Gildee, how are you?
I'm very well, man. How are you getting?
I caught you mid-sup of water there, I can tell.
Yeah. I'm so unprofessional. We only have 10 minutes, but I still got caught supping some water.
It's crazy.
Oh, God.
Listen, tell me this. Your favorite movie, you told me the other day what it is, and you'll get no argument from me, but tell our listeners what it is and why.
Yeah, my favorite movie, a proviso is that it often changes
sure.
week to week, as I'm sure you find. But I picked this one because I absolutely adore this, and it's Rushmore by Wes Anderson. And part of the reason is because I was watching it recently with my son and my daughter, 15 and 17,
okay.
and they hadn't seen it. And they're huge fans of Wes Anderson, Isle of Dogs, particularly Fantastic Mr. Fox. And yeah. I was saying, you know, they were always saying, what's your favorite one? And I gone, it's probably Rushmore. Because I think the first film you see, you fall in love with.
Mm.
And that was the first time I'd seen his movies, use the American term, and I just it was so novel and different and fresh, and I just fell in love with it because Rushmore was like nothing I'd ever seen.
Now I know you're keen, you said to me you don't want to give any kind of spoilers, but for people who haven't seen it, could you give us a sense of what it might be about without getting into the weeds on it or anything?
Yeah, totally. I mean, it's about Jason Schwartzman. He's only 15. I think yeah. it was his debut. And he falls in love with his teacher, Olivia Williams, who has lost her husband. And Schwartzman has lost his mother. So there's a sense of loss there on what they're doing to compensate and avoid life. And then he basically tries to woo her, which is hilarious. And on the scene comes Bill Murray, who sort of really liked Schwartzman and his two brutal, hilarious cartoon kids.
Yeah.
And so they end up sort of competing. It becomes a war, basically, and a fight where they try to woo her and with hilarious consequences. And some of the action's almost like from a comic.
Mm.
But because of Anderson's sort of direction, there's this deadpan energy that
yeah.
delivers the jokes, and that's why Murray, I think that's why he loves Murray, because Murray totally suits his films, because Murray is the ultimate deadpan delivery man.
Yeah.
They also go to a private school. He goes to a private school, which is really important, and he sort of runs endless quantities of clubs.
Mm.
Like he's endlessly doing all these activities, almost in a way to sort of run away from his life in a way. I think it's quite interesting that it starts in a school, because for me, like, I also love The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou.
Mm-hmm.
Some people don't, and the Royal Tenenbaums, but his films start, they're all about sort of categories and maps and descriptions of the way the world is.
Mm-hmm.
And everything's parceled away in little neat packages and drawers and copybooks, and I think it's quite interesting that he starts off with the school, because it's almost like Anderson's got this map of the world and then
yeah.
explores it in very neat detail.
That's a great way of putting it, actually. Regular listeners to this show know I'm a devotee of Anderson. I just adore him, and I'm delighted he chose that. I can't even quite remember the line, but when Bill Murray, looking at his two cartoonish-like sons, who he kind of hates, and he says, never in my wildest dreams did I imagine I'd have children like this.
Yeah, and he's got that. It's a funny thing, because I was thinking about Anderson. Like, he, you know, it's quite stylized.
Yeah.
And as he went on, like, the first three I love, because the first one was sort of like about individual. I think he explores, like, it's often in the first three films, men. Like, it's about the individual man, then Royal Tenenbaums is about family, and then Life Aquatic is about clubs,
yeah,
you know, and the way men get together. But I think as it goes on, maybe it's because I saw them, I love them, and I love Fantastic Mr. Fox, Isle of Dogs is amazing, Moonshine Kingdom's really good, but I sort of went off him slightly because he can be a bit quirky or something. But here with Rushmore, it's just absolutely perfect filmmaking. And he's got brilliant mise-en-scene. He's like Frame. you frame stuff and then a lot of stuff happens in the frame, you know. There's not a lot of camera movement, which creates a very deadpan energy as well. And then within this film, there's hilarious, they're putting on hilarious plays, like versions of Serpico and almost a Vietnam sort of play. And there's something about the plays that sort of replicate the way he shoots his movies, where things are going on in the scene, particularly with Steve Zissou. And if filmmaking is sort of the delivery of a joke, then his delivery is absolutely amazing. It's a sort of deadpan thing where things happen in the background or happen slowly. So it's just a magnificent film. And now my own kids are, can't make up their mind what their favorite movie is. Is it Fantastic Mr. Fox or is it Rushmore, you know?
Wow, kids. Well, you know, you're the opposite of Bill Murray in that. Kids who are into Wes Anderson, that sounds good to me, you know. May my toddlers grow to be the same teenagers as yours. Well, thank you for that. And that's really well described. Listen, I want to ask you about the bookshop, but just en route to that, the question you're probably asked all the time, because you, like a lot of Irish comedians, we're in Father Ted, and I imagine people ask you about that a lot, and I'm afraid I'm no exception. But isn't it strange that for something that I imagine probably took one day out of your life, it's probably followed around for the remainder of your life since then, or maybe it hasn't?
Well, it is an amazing thing. Like, it definitely has. Like, I mean, that could be a reflection on the rest of my life.
come.
You can look at it both ways. But, like obviously, I haven't done comedy gigs in England since the lockdown, which is, you know, like, when was that? Last March? Like, time is just,
I know, time is elastic now.
Last March, you know, I'd actually booked in gigs in England for the first time in a while. Like, yeah. I'd 3 or 4 weekends away. So, but when my point I'm trying to make is, in England, like, people would recognize me from that, you know. It was amazing. People still would recognize you. And it's a testament to the quality of that series. Like, because what it is it's a classic.
So you mentioned no gigs in a year, and I've spoken to a few comedians in this slot, and, you know, they've all been finding different ways, Zoom gigs or writing stuff and stuff like that. But you, as far as I understand, as I mentioned in the intro, so I do hope it's right, you opened a bookshop.
That's right, I did open. It's something I've been sort of working on. You know the way these things happen organically? So for years I'd always bought books with an idea to sell them, even though I had nowhere to sell them. So my house became full of books, but I had it. And then I sort of did a couple of car boot sales and a Christmas fair. And then in Dunleary, the council here have a brilliant thing called pop-up shops, where you can go and sell your wares, whatever they are, for a week or two. So I did that. And then that all led to negotiating different things that fell through. So last October, I opened the first secondhand bookshop, Kevin Gildee's brilliant bookshop in Dunleary, and I opened it 4.5 days before the for a lockdown.
For one of the few lockdowns last year.
Well, that's 4.5 days for the October. Then we opened at the beginning of December. Then the ceiling fell in, so I had to close. Then I opened for 2 weeks, and then I've been locked down since January. So I am, you know, really dying to get back doing that.
Okay, so this is this, but when all this madness ends, whenever that is, and retail is open again, your bookshop will be up and running again, all going to plan.
It will be up and running, and I can't wait. And I've been getting in a lot of books, so we'll have more books than ever.
Wonderful. Well, that's great.
I mean, I did, and as regards comedy, on Monday nights, I'm doing the Dublin Comedy Improv on Zoom.
Yeah.
We do a show every Monday, 8 o'clock, so you can tune into that.
Wonderful. And then finally, you mentioned just before we came on, there was an essay you wrote during lockdown that you were particularly proud of that deserves a mention.
Yeah. Well, what it was a competition for Liberty's Press. It was sort of funny short stories. I hate the word humor because I feel like it doesn't take on enough responsibility to be funny. These a competition for funny short stories, and I judged that, and there was like hundreds and hundreds of them. The quality was great, and then Liberty's Press brought out a book, which is available now. It's available in Kevin Goodie's brilliant bookshop. Or for Liberty's Press. It's Brevity is the Soul. It's a collection of the best essays. There's about 30 of them, I think.
Okay.
And I wrote an essay as a preface to that, and it's really, really good standard, like really funny stuff. It's got to be funny.
Yeah. And so just to be clear then, your bookshop, is it actually called Kevin Gildee's Brilliant Bookshop?
It is called Kevin Gildee's Brilliant Bookshop, and I got such a buzz. Like, there's something, as a comedian, you've got quite a big ego. But when when you have to be perfectly honest, you got to have it. Because you're going out there on your own. You got to protect yourself, man. But it's true. There is an element, you know, you have to have an ego. But I walked by the shop when this brilliant guy put up the sign for me, and I was just looking and going, Kevin Gildee's Brilliant Bookshop on a building in Delirio's Gar. Man, that out egos my comedy ego, man.
Well, fair play to you. His favorite movie is Rushmore by Wes Anderson. You can see him on Monday nights on Zoom for the Comedy Improv. His wonderful bookshop, Kevin Gildee's Brilliant Bookshop, will be returning to the, is it the High Street, Kevin, in Dunleary?
It's actually Georgia Street Lower.
Okay.
And the number is 46A, which is one of the buses that go out to Dunleary.
Right. Well, 46A. You literally can't miss it. Kevin, thank you very much.
Thanks a million. Take care.
I like your nurse's uniform, guy.
These are OR scrubs.
Oh, are they? Well, they're totally inappropriate for the occasion.
Well, I didn't know we were going to dinner.
That's because you weren't invited.
Take it easy, Max.
You were the one that ordered him a whiskey and soda.
So what's wrong with that? I can write a hit play, why can't I have a little drink to unwind myself? So tell me, Curly, how do you know Miss Cross?
We went to Harvard together.
Oh, that's great. I wrote a hit play and directed it. So I'm not sweating it either.
A clip there from the wonderful Rushmore from Wes Anderson, as chosen by my guest, Kevin Gildee. And my thanks to him, and I'm looking forward to seeing his new bookshop when all this is over. That's it for this week. My thanks to Anne-Marie Kane, who helped out on the show. Just to remind you, this show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the Newstalk app or wherever you get your podcasts. And it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. right here on Newstalk. I'm open on Twitter all week long, John_Fardy, or you can email me, screentime@newstalk.com. Next week on the show, really looking forward to it, me and Mark Ryle are bringing you a special where we're talking about our favorite road movies. So I'm looking forward to that next week. Leave you with some music from the movies. We were talking about Rushmore, and this is The Faces and Ooh La La. Have a wonderful weekend.
Poor old granddad, I laughed at all his words. I thought he was a bitter man. He spoke of women's ways. The trap you